I'm Fran Kelly, and every day on the Radio National Hour, I take a deep breath and dive in.
If you can have a chip implanted in your brain to help control traumatic memory, then all you have to do is drop the adjective traumatic and it can control memory.
And he said, oh, well, we'll just take your stomach out. And in my head, I was like, how do you live without a stomach?
We're a funny species, Fran. You know, I think we're the only animal who seems to be hell-bent on their own destruction.
So if you want to know how to live without a stomach, or more about David Wenham's ideas for world peace, come find me on the Radio National Hour, right here on ABC Listen.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, we're going to mark the life of one of the country's most well-known Australians of the year. Professor Richard Scollier has died following a lengthy and consequential battle with brain cancer.
His tenacity in the face of this terrible battle he was having, and the whole time thinking about others and solutions for others, truly astonishing.
We'll hear those reflections from Governor-General Sam Mostyn, and also anecdotes from an old mate of Professor Scollier's, who today is being recognised with a King's Birthday honour, the former Tasmanian Premier, Will Hodgman.
I know there'll be a lot of debate today about whether or not people like me and others are deserving of these awards, but I doubt there would be anyone who would question Richard Scollier getting his.
And another Radio National favourite is also on the King's Birthday honours list, former breakfast host Fran Kelly. She'll be here too, reflecting on 17 years of hosting Radio National Breakfast and even her history fronting a rock band. All of that is coming up. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Hey, thanks for joining us for another episode of The Breakfast Wrap. Today on this King's Birthday public holiday, sorry to the Queenslanders and Western Australians still working, we are here with you in solidarity, and we are happy to bring you another pretty packed episode of The Wrap. We are going to kick off, however, with pretty sad news. News that we learnt overnight about the death of a pretty special Australian, Professor Richard Scollier, who was a pioneer of melanoma research. When he was diagnosed with an aggressive brain tumour back in 2023, he took the radical approach of volunteering to basically be patient zero in a revolutionary cancer treatment. It sent his cancer into remission for nearly 2 years, but his tumour returned early last year. In an open letter, he said he wanted to be remembered as a proud everyday Aussie who gave it a crack and inspired others to pursue their dreams and passions with humility, love, and compassion. This morning, we learnt that he has died, aged 59, after battling what he described as the worst of the worst brain cancers. We learnt the news after booking a string of interviews discussing today's King's Birthday honours list. And one of them was with the former Tasmanian Premier, Will Hodgman, who revealed to Sally, in his first answer, his connection to the late Professor.
What's it like for you and your family today?
A very deep mix of emotions. There's immense pride and gratitude. Of course, it's a great honour from the greatest country on earth, but it's immensely humbling. I've always truly felt that my work is simply just one form of public service, and I haven't sought recognition. I'd rather success be measured by impact, and I'm very mindful that whatever I've done has only been possible by having wonderful people around me, including my family, most notably. And I think this honour reflects in my mind the contribution that so many people have made supporting me, and also that there are so many extraordinary people around the country often doing incredible things without recognition like this. So it's truly humbling, and I have to say also today I'm extremely saddened at the news of the death of Richard Scollier, who truly represents a great Australian. I went through university in Tasmania with Scully, played footy with him. Amazing man. It's very sad to see news of his death. So I'm sure today many people will be reflecting on the extraordinary contribution he made.
What was Richard Scollier like as a young fella, not only at uni but football and elsewhere? He seems to have had such a lot of humility about him.
Absolutely. He himself, very humble, modest, but an extraordinary individual, a high achiever, very driven. He was a tremendous sports person, very sociable type, very well liked, loved across the community, and of course very smart, and went on to do truly incredible things. And I was pleased to catch up with him in later years, albeit under the most difficult of circumstances, when he won his award, because it accurately, I think, reflects what that award's all about and what a truly great Australian is. I know there'll be a lot of debate today about whether or not people like me and others are deserving of these awards, but I doubt there would be anyone who would question Richard Scollier getting his.
Yeah, I spoke to Richard Scollier a couple of years ago on our summer reading segment, Will, and we were talking about books and stories, and he was talking about how his story was changing since he was diagnosed with cancer. Sometimes he would get an update and the news was good and he would relay that to his family. Sometimes that would be completely turned on its head and the outlook was very different. What did you make of his courage in the way that he dealt with it? Because it wasn't a linear thing. There were so many ups and downs. There was hope and then there wasn't and then there was again.
Oh, incredible he was, and unwavering in his optimism and positivity against the most traumatic of circumstances, to see his lovely family clearly suffering, but Scully just holding firm, resolute, and conveying to the rest of us that there is always hope is a truly remarkable legacy, which, you know, like these awards today, I hope inspire others to contribute in their own way across their community, as always happens. But with this motivation, it will certainly inspire me to do more.
And that is the former Tasmanian Premier, Will Hodgman, there, talking about his old footy mate, the late Professor Richard Scollier. Learning about the news overnight, our team hit the phones early this morning to speak to others who knew about Richard. And we landed this interview with the Governor-General, Sam Mostyn, just minutes before she boarded a flight.
Your Excellency, welcome to Radio National Breakfast.
Good morning, Sally. Very sad news that we've woken to today.
It is. What did you most admire of Richard Scollier?
I guess he summed it up in those words about himself, an extraordinary human being. You heard reflections on his early life earlier from another honours winner this morning. I think that was beautiful about the fact that his character was quite set early, tenacious, driven, I think was a word that was used, which you can only be if you're going to achieve the things that Richard has done. But I think those words of compassion and grace and care, right up until the very end, and his tenacity in the face of this terrible battle he was having, and the whole time thinking about others and solutions and medical interventions for others, truly astonishing. And I know he described himself as an ordinary Australian, but I think he was an extraordinary Australian throughout his life. And I'm very, very sorry and want to send condolences to his family, to Katie and their children. I met Richard a number of times after he became the Joint Australian of the Year, and there was no more deserving recipient of that award at the time, and the work that he and Georgina did during that year was astonishing.
His academic and medical contributions in melanoma research were world-renowned. In the way that he conducted his job and the way that he dealt with his diagnosis of brain cancer, what do you think he taught Australians?
I think he taught us that, one, you never give up, that you continue to fight for the thing you care about most. And for him, it was less about his own survival, but using his brain cancer to think about others, and the work that was done, pioneering work that was done together with Georgina to treat his cancer using remarkable new technology that would go on to benefit others. Again, just one of those things that's hard to fathom how he became a patient, but in the interest of others. And that story will always be with us. I'm very delighted that there is a Richard Scollier chair at the Chris O'Brien Lifehouse now, so we will remember him in many ways. But his generosity, his lack of of sense of self in all of this. It was always about others and using his own illness as a means to help others. And, of course, all the work that was done on melanoma has helped us be a much better country with some of the highest rates of that disease. Mm. So his legacy is simply astonishing.
What's it like for you as Governor-General? We have these lists coming out on Australia Day and the King's Birthday. In a few months' time, you get to meet many of these Australians when they receive their honours, particularly the OAM, the Order of Australia Medal, people who have been serving their communities. What's it like to hear about the lives of the people who are doing so much, often very, very quietly? They don't get much recognition.
Well, you know, one of your former colleagues, James Valentine, who sadly passed recently, who was celebrated recently, when he interviewed me a few years ago about Australia Day, he ended the interview saying, "Do I get it that every day is Australia Day for you?" And I've never forgotten him saying that, because that is, even though I deal with some really tough things and are there for both the light and shade of our community and our country, most days I am meeting those people who I think are doing the work in community. Many of them do receive OAMs, as you said. I'm disappointed always there aren't more people nominated. This is a great day to both celebrate everybody on the honours list, but also to think about who's missing. And I think there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people across the country who probably think that the awards are made by a council somewhere anonymously, but every award under our honours system is made from a nomination from someone in the community. And I think we need to see more of these sorts of nominations, the ones you've described, the unsung heroes, those who go above and beyond. Women need to be nominated much, much more. They're very poorly represented in nominations. But these are the heroes that keep them. I think of them as the social fabric of the country. They show up everywhere in every form. They embody generosity and care and kindness. And I think they are ultimately great Australian values. And I love seeing them celebrated. And I'm truly humbled every time I meet someone who's honoured. And then those who should be honoured that I get the great privilege to meet.
It's lovely when you see people whose names have been on community rosters for decades and decades, and then that list, they're on the list for an Order of Australia is kind of lovely.
It's perfect.
I know, Your Excellency, you have a flight to catch, although I'm sure they won't go without you. You have an interesting assignment today, and that is the Big Freeze, paying tribute to another wonderful Australian who we've lost in the past couple of weeks, Neil Danaher, and his fight against motor neurone disease.
It is interesting that these two men that we've lost most recently are joined in many ways. They were both Australians of the Year, Richard in 2024 and Neil Danaher in 2025. And within a fortnight, we've lost both of them in circumstances that that teach us so much and tell us so much about them and how we can all be better. I am going down to pay a big tribute to Neil Danaher today at the Big Freeze 12 at the MCG. I am somewhat controversially going down the slide into the ice bath. Some might say that lacks dignity, but my response is simply that Neil Danaher, when he was Australian of the Year, asked me to do this, and I've spoken with his family and, as Neil would say, play on. So I'm playing on.
Your Excellency, thank you so much for taking the call this morning, and stay warm as much as you can today. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Sally, I just ask people to be gentle on me when I come up out of that bath.
You live near Lake Burley Griffin. I'm sure you're used to cold water.
Well trained.
Indeed, yeah. Lovely. Your Excellency, thank you so much.
And that is the Governor-General there, Sam Mostyn. We will return to the King's Birthday Honours List shortly with Fran Kelly. Well, it was a pretty busy morning of news today. We woke to significant developments out of the Middle East. News of Iran firing missiles at Israel for the first time since the ceasefire was agreed to back in April. Now, it appears this is in response to Israel firing on southern Beirut on the weekend. Israel and Lebanon agreed last week to renew their truce, but then just days later, Israel carried out deadly airstrikes on Beirut, killing at least two people and injuring nearly a dozen. The dynamic that we're watching right now is to see if these strikes on Israel continue and then how Israel responds. By the time you're listening to this, that may have already happened, but the guest you're about to hear from will help you understand why. There's pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu right now to carry out a really severe response. His far-right National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gavir, posting online that tonight Tehran must burn. But it sounds like that is exactly what Donald Trump doesn't want to happen. According to American outlet Axios, he has called Benjamin Netanyahu to warn him against responding. And there's pressure from all around the world for both sides to de-escalate.
It's incredibly unhelpful, and we continue to call for de-escalation. We want the ceasefire to hold and a long-term peace to be negotiated and agreed to so that the Strait of Hormuz can be reopened, and all parties need to take a breath, de-escalate and find a solution to what's occurring there.
That from our earlier interview with the federal government's defence industry minister, Pat Conroy. So someone with a really informed insight into the calculations happening right now is Jennifer Govito. She's the former US Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iran and Iraq. And here is her interview with Sally.
In light of Israel's attack on Beirut's southern suburbs earlier today, this isn't a terribly surprising development. I would note that, you know, we're hearing reports that it's maybe four missiles that were launched from Tehran at Israel, which is a fairly subdued response and may indicate that Tehran is not necessarily looking for an escalation, but rather responding to a red line that it had struck out. And so I think what we'll have to look for over the next hours is whether Israel similarly responds in a de-escalatory manner or whether it takes the opportunity to reignite the broader conflict.
Is some sort of Israeli response, even if it's to mark its own retaliatory response, is that almost inevitable? Or do you think that President Trump is able to get Israel to hold back?
So certainly I think President Trump will attempt to get Israel to hold back. I do think that some response is really inevitable. But again, whether he can convince Israel to do so in a manner that avoids further escalation, I think remains to be seen. Certainly for Prime Minister Netanyahu, though, who would prefer that this conflict actually between the United States and Iran reignite, I think that this is an opportunity he will not want to pass up.
What would from a strategic point of view, a proportionate response from Israel, what would that look like?
Perhaps, you know, a single set of responses against one or two very discrete targets, something that doesn't, cause widespread destruction, but rather is, you know, aimed at taking out a certain capability. And so in this case, given that these were missiles fired, perhaps strikes against Iran's missile facilities. And Israel can always message, of course, to Tehran, as Tehran has done to Israel, saying, you know, essentially, we've done what we're going to do and we'll call this over. I don't think that's what's going to happen, but that possibility is there.
What does it mean for peace talks?
So it's interesting. President Trump, again today, noted that he had thought in advance of this latest escalation that the peace talks were leading to some sort of agreement. We, of course, have heard that repeatedly over the last couple of months. But I think it suggests that those conversations remain ongoing, which we've known, and that the two parties remain fairly close to reaching some sort of a deal. Now, neither party wants to make the sorts of concessions that might be necessary in order to get it across the line. And I think that's why we continue to be in this space. But I do think it reaffirms that President Trump really would prefer a negotiated settlement than to go back into open conflict.
Jennifer Govito there, the former US Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iran and Iraq. We'll be following this story closely throughout the week. Well, lastly today, we are going to return to the King's Birthday Honours list. And Frances Margaret Kelly has been appointed as an Officer of the Order of Australia for distinguished service to broadcast journalism and social justice. Now, of course, you probably know her better as Fran Kelly. She was the beloved presenter of Radio National Breakfast for 17 years. And she now comes to you at the other end of the day, presenting the Radio National Hour and also the Party Room podcast on ABC Listen. And this morning, she had a wonderful chat with Sally.
You're from a close family, Fran. What do you think your mum and dad would have made of all of this?
Well, you know what? One of my, I of course sent it to the family WhatsApp early this morning and got a lot of messages back. And my niece said, Margaret and Frank would have been so proud today. And in fact, my big sister, who's now passed away, she's already got one. So like my mum would have, I tell you, my dad, he wouldn't have cared one jot, but my mum, she would have been beside herself.
Was your mum manning the radio over many years earlier in your career whenever you were on?
She was. She used to. My dad's a bit hard of hearing, and when I'd come on the radio, Dad might be out in the shed or something, and Mum had a cowbell, and she would bang the cowbell for Dad to come in and listen. But later, when Mum was gone and Dad was alone, you know, I'd go visit him, and I'd always check the radio was tuned to Radio National so he could hear me, thinking that's what he'd want, and I'd retune it every time. And in the end, he said, "Darling, don't bother. I'm not really interested in anything you talk about."
You've had an interesting trajectory into journalism and broadcasting. Back in the day, you were the lead singer of Melbourne's girls garage band called Toxic Shock.
Great band name, you've got to admit, Sally.
It is. Back in your rock chick days, could you ever have imagined being in this position now and the career that you've had? And still never, continue to have.
Mm. Never could have thought of it. And actually, the notion of journalism came to me sort of quite suddenly and quite late and became a passion, and then I did everything I could to get in. But no, of course not, Sal. You know, you could never – I mean, when could you ever imagine this? When you're starting out, you know, for me it was the Triple J. Then I was a sports reporter for a minute. And, you know, you could just never imagine this moment. Which even today I couldn't have imagined this moment. So, yeah, that's true. I never would have imagined it.
What's the secret to a good interview?
The first question, Tim Latham taught me that. Actually, Helen Thomas, who I worked with in my first job in journalism at Triple J, she was the interviewer. She was the host of the show, The Drum. And she was a terrific interviewer. And I looked and learned from her about just her curiosity, her, you know, not sort of putting her opinion on it, not labelling an interview with sort of her views, but just trying to, you know, bring a person out of themselves. And I another great teacher I had in interviewing was the late, great Paul Murphy from the PM program, and I really learnt at his knee, I think. But Tim Latham, who was founded together, we made the RN Breakfast show that, you know, which I came to present all those years ago. And he was a master of the first question, and his philosophy was if you get the first question right, the rest of the interview will take care of itself. And I've kind of lived and died by that ever since.
What is a good first question? How does that work, do you think?
You don't waste it, Sally. You don't waste it easing into something. You just get straight to the heart of it without being confrontational, but with being sharp and to the point. You know, we are going here today. That's what you want from the first question.
You presented Breakfast for 17 years, which deserves a pause to take in that number because it's an incredibly
long time. I think it deserves an AO, Sally.
What kept you in that role for that period of time, giving you the energy to get up and do it all again today, tomorrow, the next day, the next day?
Well, I loved it. I never wanted to leave Breakfast. I loved it every single day. I loved the, you know, you know this, Sally, you come off air and you feel like you've just conducted an orchestra through a concert. It's like this massive piece of work and adrenaline roll, and you're rolling from one thing to the other, and you're just getting all your sort of passions met and saturated through each show. Because the show is so broad and so wonderful. You get to do the agenda-setting news interviews, you get to do the cultural interviews or talk to the favourite scientist or honour the great Richard Scollier today. You know, it's just such, it fills you up, and you're hoping that it fills up the audience too, because that's why you're doing it. And when I left Breakfast and there was an outpouring of love, that was the most wonderful moment of my life ever, really, because I suddenly knew that the audience understood what we're trying to do here every day and loved it and appreciated it. So, yeah, it's just such a great program to have the honour of doing. In the end, it was only that my body was crying at the thought of getting up at 3:30 every morning that I gave it away. But yeah, it's such a wonderful, wonderful thing to have been able to do.
And that is the wonderful Fran Kelly there. You can catch her throughout the week on the Radio National Hour at 6 p.m. on the wireless and also ABC Listen. And you can find Radio National Breakfast at the other end of the day from 6 a.m. every single morning. Today's Brekkie Wrap episode was produced by Oscar Coleman. And I'm Luke Sidham-Dunton. See you tomorrow.